MacCast, Monday, January 27th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we got a big episode for you today. Lots of stuff to talk about. Apple had its first quarterly results call of 2014, and there's some really good stuff in there, as you might guess. Also, we've got rumors of new iPhones and iPads to continue talking about. And Apple updated a ton of applications over the past week or so. So we're going to dive into all of those. And of course, then we have your questions and your feedback. We're going to talk a little bit about why we are Mac users here, since it has just recently been the 30th anniversary of the Macintosh. So how did we all get here? Have a listener looking for some Mac upgrade and buying advice. We're going to address that. And also an audio issue affecting some Macs, maybe yours. All of that and a whole lot more. But before we get into that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. You know, I've told you about PDF Pen, the different applications in the PDF Pen family, but we've never talked about the family as a whole. And that's really what it is. You have PDF Pen for the Mac, PDF Pen for your iPad, PDF Pen for iPhone, and now PDF Pen Scan Plus. And you put all those together, and what you have is a really powerful collection of applications that'll allow you to capture, manage, and edit your PDFs. It's a great solution because all of those applications work together seamlessly to help you get the job done. You start off with PDF Pen Scan Plus. That allows you to capture, to crop and straighten, and even OCR documents right on your iOS device. So it's like having a scanner in your pocket, and those go right into PDFs that you can then bring into PDF Pen on your iPhone or your iPad, or even bring it back to your Mac, and then you can manage and edit your PDFs from those applications. You can do things like create forms from fake forms. Fake forms are those things where you get a document and it looks like a form, but it's not really. It doesn't have the fill-in fields. No one ever did the work to set it up right. You can do that right inside PDF Pen. You can also get rid of information, you can redact information, and you can do it securely because it's not just going to let you draw a box over the PDF, but it will also pull out the underlying metadata associated with that. So if it's been OCR'd and you've got that OCR data underneath, it'll pull that out so somebody can't recover that. And one of my favorite features is you can add signatures and draw right on top of your PDF. So I add signatures all the time. That way, I can go completely paperless. Someone can email me a PDF, and if I need to secure it, PDF Pen will also allow you to create a secured PDF. And best of all those PDFs can be synced up with iCloud or with Dropbox. They also have support for Evernote, Box, and Google Docs. So wherever you are, you will have access to your documents from the cloud, and you can sync everything up. And right now, you can check out a cool video Smile put together that explains how the whole family of PDF Pen products works together. You can click the link in the podcast right now on your iOS device or your Mac. You can also go to maccast.com and click the link there to check out the video explaining how the whole PDF Pen family of products can help you create a PDF workflow that will make you smile. I love Smile. I love all of their products, and I think you will too. You can check them all out, smilesoftware.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. On Monday, Apple held its first fiscal quarter 2014 financial conference call, and once again, they broke all kinds of records. The revenues were at $57.6 billion, with net profits of $13 billion. That was up 6%. Over the same quarter a year ago. Apple sold 51 million iPhones in the quarter, generating $32.5 billion in revenue. That was up 51% from the prior quarter and 7% year over year. iPads accounted for $11.4 billion in revenue, with Apple selling 26 million of them. That's an 85% increase over the last quarter and a 14% jump year over year. 4.8 million Macs were sold, accounting for $6.4 billion in sales, and that's a 6% increase over the prior quarter and up 19% year over year. And that's with the PC industry in general losing about 10% in shipments, according to IDC. The one obvious and big expected decline was in iPod sales. Those were down a whopping 52% year over year and only generated Apple $1 billion in revenue. Yes, a billion with a B. So even in decline, the iPad is still generating a lot of dollars for Apple. I think a lot of companies would be happy selling a billion worth of almost anything. Apple also did well in retail and online. $4.4 billion of revenue came through Apple Retail, a 19% increase over last year. And iTunes services made $4.4 billion in the quarter, with $2.4 billion in sales coming from iTunes alone. And with all that money flowing in, you would think Apple's cash hoard went up quite a bit, but it now stands at just $158.8 billion, which I think is down just slightly from the last time it was reported. And yes, I did say just $158.8 billion. I know, it's kind of funny. But you have to also remember that Apple did give back about $7.7 billion to their shareholders. Now, during the conference call, as I was listening, I think Apple's executives seemed audibly thrilled to be reporting the outstanding numbers for the quarter, and why shouldn't they be? I think the only people possibly on the planet who could have been disappointed with Apple's results would be Wall Street. They found some way to hate numbers like this. Apple's stock actually went down over 8% in after-hours trading. This is not uncommon. It happens a lot when Apple announces their numbers. There's usually a dip in the stock price. And most of the reason why it happens, and I think that what it's exactly what happened this time, is that they are responding to Apple's guidance that they gave during the call. Apple said it would report between $42 billion and $44 billion in revenues next quarter, but analysts were expecting guidance more along the lines of $46.1 billion. So that $4.1 billion difference, yeah, that accounts for an 8% drop in the stock price. I think they were also a little bit concerned about iPhone sales moving forward as well, but I don't know. I can't figure out Wall Street. If you can, let us know. Try and explain it to us. Send us a brief email or an audio comment at maccast@gmail.com. But it's my understanding it's the guidance that that causes the stock price to go down like that. Now, after the call, there is a Q&A session, and there's a lot of information that comes out during that. We also get some additional information that Apple puts out on their feed. So from all of that, there's some interesting notes about Apple's quarterly results. One is that the revenue from the Americas actually declined 1% year over year and was down to $20.098 billion, about $20.1 billion. So that means that a lot of the revenue came from outside the Americas. Europe and Japan were actually up 5 and 11% respectively, and China's revenue was up a whopping 29%, coming in at $8.844 billion. iOS 7 has also been installed on 80% of compatible iOS devices, so that's an amazing adoption rate for the new operating system. And Tim Cook commented on innovation at Apple. He was asked about it and said, you know, basically, innovation isn't dead at Apple. If anything, it's too good. Apple is just really careful about where they choose to focus their attention. His quote, his exact quote was, "We have zero issue coming up with things we want to do disrupt in a major way. The challenge is always to focus on the very few that deserve all of our energy. We've always done that, and we'll continue to focus on that." So basically telling people, look, we got a lot of stuff in development. We got a ton of ideas. We're just trying to figure out where we can make the most impact and impact and where we want to really focus our energy. And Apple's always done that. This is nothing new. And that's how they make such an impact on specific categories and verticals and stuff like that. They're looking to do something big, and they've just got to figure out what that thing is. Is it going to be television? Is it going to be wearable? I'm leaning at this point toward the wearables more than the television stuff. I think television stuff may come next year, but only time will tell, and only Apple really knows at this point. But overall, great quarter for Apple. I don't think anybody can dispute that, even Wall Street. 2014 could be the year that Apple matches PC sales one-to-one. This story actually came a little over a week ago. I didn't talk about it on the last MacCast, but at least one analyst thinks that Apple could match PC sales one-for-one in the coming year. This came from a Simco's Horace Dedu. He says that this year, sales of Apple products will match sales of Windows PCs. To be fair, he's counting iPads and iPhones along with Macs against just Windows PCs. He's not including sales of Windows phones or Windows tablets. And while those are small, they're not insignificant. So I'm taking this one kind of with a grain of salt. It would only, though, likely delay when the event would happen. I don't think it would prevent the thing from actually taking place at some point. It's just a matter of when will we get to that one-to-one ratio, because Windows phones and tablets are not really taking off. I think Apple is going to continue to progress forward, and Mac sales are going up, as we heard from the quarterly results numbers. So I think that sort of crossover point is just inevitable. Now, specifically, Dedu's data shows that last year there were only 1.18 more Windows PCs than Apple devices sold. And John Gruber points out that the shift in ratios actually started way back when the iPod was announced, which was well before the release of the iPhone. Dedu put up a graph, and if you look at that, you start seeing the shift, the trend of this ratio change happening about the time the iPod starts to hit. Now, it ramps up more quickly when we get the iPhone and the iPad, but in the transition from desktops to notebooks and other devices, basically what Tim Cook calls the post-PC era, Apple has been significantly ahead of the curve, and that's what's allowing them to catch up so quickly. Apple's Halo strategy is key to this, in my opinion, because it is that is actually converting a lot of PC owners over to Mac owners. And what I found particularly telling this week was that when Apple put up the 30th anniversary information up on the Apple website, if you go there, if you haven't been there, first, go check this out. They put up a great tribute to the Macintosh on its 30th anniversary on their website. And one of the features in that sort of little mini site was asking people to tell Apple what was your first Mac. So you could go in and you could select the Mac model that was your very first Mac. And Apple keeps updating the data. You can see the top five Macs that people have picked as their first Mac. And looking at it right now, it's Monday evening, about 11 o'clock. The Macintosh, the 1984 edition of the Macintosh, is first with 3.5%. But then you have the 2011 MacBook Pro at 2.9%, almost 3%. You have the 2012 MacBook Pro at 2.9%, again, almost 3%. And you have the 2009 MacBook Air, followed by the 2013 MacBook Pro with Retina display. Now, keep in mind, this is the first Mac that someone has ever owned. So the first one is from 1984, but the next four are from 2009 on. So these are new people coming to the Mac, and Apple's retail sales numbers have always backed that up. Apple, for a long time, would say that more than 50% of the people coming into an Apple retail store were buying their first Mac. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing in this trend, and that's what Dedu is responding to, is we're going to get to this point where there's this one-to-one ratio. And even if you take those extra devices out, you take the tablets and the iPhones out and compare just Macs to PCs, the trend still stands. In 2004, the ratio of PCs to Macs were 56 to 1. Last year, it was just 18.8 to 1. So Apple is quickly catching up. And in a post-PC world, all bets are off because Apple has a really big lead over Windows. Now, it'd be interesting to do a similar analysis, including Android. I didn't see those numbers in what Dedu was putting out, but an interesting trend nonetheless. And we'll have to see if 2014 does turn out to be the year where the ratio becomes one to one. I am going to go out on a limb and say that this year, a larger screen iPhone is inevitable. It is going to happen. And the reason I'm going to go out on a limb, and it's, believe me, a very small limb, and say that is that almost every source out there is saying exactly the same thing. They're saying, one, that the next round of iPhones will have larger screens, and two, that it will be screens, not just screen. Most are saying two different size iPhones. What's not agreed on is the size and type of the display, so I thought I'd go over some of the latest folks who are throwing out the rumor and exactly what they have to say. First, we have Display Search. They say that there's going to be a lower-end option with a 4.7-inch display with a resolution of 1600 by 1900 pixels. That would be a 386 pixel per inch density. And then also a second model with a huge 5.5-inch display. That's huge for Apple, not huge for some of its competitors. That would have a resolution of 1920 by 1080, coming in at 407 pixels per inch. And just for kicks, they also predict that the 12.9-inch iPad display, the rumored iPad Pro display, will be a 2732 by 2048 pixel resolution panel. Then a Chinese publication, Tencent, says that it's going to be a 4.7-inch iPhone 6 model, and it will enter production as soon as May. I would assume that would mean a summer release, which, again, already in my mind sort of throws this one out a little bit, because I think fall is going to be the release schedule for the iPhone. But they say it will have the same resolution as the current iPhone, another tick in my mind against this rumor, but that Apple will quickly follow up with a 5.7-inch higher resolution model later. They don't say if it's later that year or the next year, but 4.7 and a 5.7 for the Chinese publication. Now, Tim Akuri of Cowen and Company, an analyst, says that the design is actually already locked down. Apple's already picked the display for the iPhone 6, and it is a 4.8-inch panel, and that the new iPhone will also come with 802.11 AC Wi-Fi. So upping the Wi-Fi finally, like many people are hoping, to 802.11 AC. We'll have to wait and see on. I think it's something Apple would want to do. Typically, it's been rumored that battery life might be a little bit of an issue for 802.11 AC, but I think it's inevitable and probably will come with the next generation. And then finally, we have the Wall Street Journal. They say, again, two model iPhones. One will be a screen between 4.5 and 5 inches, and then a second model whose screen will go beyond 5 inches. They're being a little bit more vague about the actual size of the display. I think the most common size that we're hearing is about a 4.7, 4.8-inch display, and then another one that would come in around 5.5 inches. Overall, I haven't done an official analysis, but just going off of memory, I think that's where it's sort of falling in the range of. I can see 4.7, 4.8. I think I could probably live with that. Getting up over 5 inches, those get into that gigantophone territory, and I am, as you know, not a huge fan. I know a lot of people do like that size phone. I'm just curious to see if Apple will actually do two different sized displays. I would think they want to keep to one form factor as they move things up, but you never know. They may be playing around with different sizes and just decide that we're going to have a lower-end model and a higher-end model. That's the way most of the rumors seem to be going, so we'll just run with that for the moment until we hear otherwise. One theory that I had is maybe that one model would be the upgrade to the iPhone 5C and the other one would be the upgrade to the 5S. Another rumor that kind of happened this week surrounding the 5C is that some sources are saying the new version will have a metal casing, or that Apple is basically getting rid of the iPhone 5C. It's not really clear at this point whether that would go away. Tim Cook was asked about the 5C during the conference call. He didn't say Apple was getting rid of the model, but he did allude to the fact that it did not meet Apple's expectations in terms of their projections for sales. As for when we will see an iPhone 6, as I said, I think it's going to be in the fall. Most of the sources seem to be pointing to toward the second half of the year. One thing that the Wall Street Journal piece pointed out was that it will not have a curved display. That was another thing that has been rumored, that Apple would go with a curved display. I don't see the appeal of that. There is, I guess, some argument to be made that it can help reduce the reflectivity and some of the sort of highlighting, which can throw off colors and things like that, make it harder to read. If there's a huge benefit, I could see Apple doing it. But so far, I think some of the curved displays out on the market really haven't been well received. And I think Apple pays attention to those sorts of reactions. So maybe they were looking into it at one point, but I don't think it's going to be a thing that most consumers are really clamoring for. So I think Apple might just choose to leave it out, because I think it adds some complexity even to the manufacturing process. And as you know, Apple's had issues with screens in the past and yields and things like that, which can tend to slow down the release cycle. And again, looking back at the quarterly results call, Apple did mention that iPhone sales could have been a little bit higher had they been able to get more iPhone, specifically iPhone 5Ss, into the channel more quickly. Some other additions with rumors surrounding the iPhone 6. It will reportedly have an 8-megapixel camera, but improved optical image stabilization features, as well as an f1.8 lens, according to some sources. It's expected to be slimmer, but heavier than the prior iPhone models, which, when you think about it, makes sense. If it's going to have a bigger screen, it's going to have more glass, which is going to equal a little bit more weight. But that glass might be a different kind of material, specifically sapphire. In the past, Apple has relied on Gorilla Glass, but reportedly Apple's manufacturing partner, Foxconn, has said to have successfully assembled at least 100 prototype next-generation iPhone units using sapphire displays. And Apple's partner, GT Advanced Technologies, is set to open a sapphire glass manufacturing plant in Arizona. As a matter of fact, Tim Cook confirmed in a recent interview that that plant would be producing sapphire glass, although he did not say when they would be actually beginning production, nor what products it would be for. It's also been rumored that sapphire glass might be used for Apple's rumored iWatch project. And to me, that seems like a more likely application. Apple has used sapphire glass to cover the Touch ID sensor. Also, it's been used to cover up the lenses on their iOS devices, but it's typically been reported that it's pretty expensive to produce, and to create a large piece for the front of an iPhone display, I would think would be a little bit costly, and they're going to have to figure out a lot of manufacturing issues. Seems like it would be easier to put it in a smaller device and sort of test it out. So it may just be that the ones that Foxconn reportedly put together are simply prototype devices, although if they put together 100 of them, that would sort of imply that Apple is moving into some pretty significant testing. The question I would have would be, have they worked out the manufacturing in a way that they can produce those panels at a really high volume? And I would think they, again, would want to start with something a little bit simpler. But if they can get a sapphire glass display in a next-generation iPhone, that would be a huge feat and something really big for marketing the next-generation device, give them a leg up on some of their competitors. So it wouldn't be surprising if that's what gets announced. Digitimes is reporting that Apple is now prepping the so-called iPad Pro, that 12.9-inch iPad we've been hearing about, for a late 2014 third quarter launch. They say that Apple has been accelerating development in response to Samsung's introduction of two competing 12.2-inch tablet models. I think they announced those at CES, and that's sort of where this rumor really breaks down for me. Digitimes historically has been hit or miss on the Apple rumors, but the fact that they're claiming Apple is doing anything in response to Samsung immediately invalidates the rumor for me. Apple never does anything in response to Samsung. The feeling, though, is that Apple wants to put out a larger iPad, something that would bridge the gap between the tablet and the notebook markets. Again, another point kind of against this rumor, in my opinion, because I think it just sort of serves to confuse the marketplace a little bit. And Apple has always shied away from this sort of tablet, notebook, hybrid kind of philosophy, right? You have a tablet, which is one thing in one experience. You have a notebook, which is another thing in another experience. They have two separate operating systems. And as a matter of fact, the Apple executives came out in an interview and reiterated their sort of mantra that really they're two different devices, two different experiences. So I start thinking about a 12.9-inch iPad Pro, and there seems to be more questions in my mind than answers. Things like, what about storage? I think you would need to have at least 256 gigabytes of storage in a iPad Pro product, but then you're starting to enter into that notebook territory. Also, what about confusion with a MacBook Air? You've got a 13-inch iPad Pro, you've got a 13-inch MacBook Air. I would assume the iPad Pro would come with some sort of Apple design keyboard accessory. At that point, isn't it just like a MacBook Air, a 13-inch MacBook Air? The main difference, of course, being the operating systems and a touchscreen, but then why not just do a touchscreen MacBook Air? Personally, a product that I think no one would want. And Apple is usually about the user experience. So this really comes down to Apple working out some sort of use case or user experience for a Pro tablet. And the only use case I can really think of would be some sort of device targeted at artists, at media creators, people like that. And are you going to have, at that point, a pressure-sensitive stylus and pen, something more like a Wacom Cintiq? There's just a lot of things to think about. See, like I said, a lot more questions than answers. But I think Apple will have some of those answers for us. I think a 12.9-inch iPad Pro is definitely something that they're looking into. I think it's very likely it's going to come out this year. What I'm really curious to see is how Apple markets and positions it and sort of what they figured out in terms of how we're going to use it. But I'm sure they will have those answers for us when and if they release that kind of product. This week, unfortunately, we have reports of some MacBook Pros and some MacBook Airs having hardware issues. Let's start with the MacBook Pros. Owners of early 2011 MacBook Pro models, the ones with discrete AMD GPUs, are reporting in a growing 190-plus page thread on Apple support communities some video issues. The issues seem to arise during graphics-intensive operations, doing things like viewing high-definition videos or running really heavy computing tasks that rely on the GPU. And when doing those kinds of operations, users report getting video tearing, or even worse, having their screens go completely blank. Now, there's been reported a couple temporary workarounds and fixes. You can try doing things if your Mac is being affected, like rebooting into safe mode. You can try resetting the PRAM or NVRAM, also rebooting into single user mode, and running an FSCK disk check can reportedly resolve the issue for a little while, or even completely reinstalling OS X. Some users have reported that that seems to fix things. But what's really going on is it looks like the discrete AMD GPU is having some sort of problem, possibly related to heat issues. This is something that Apple has had issues with on other Mac models. Specifically, I have a 14-inch white iBook G4 that was particularly plagued by heat issues, where eventually heat would cause cracks in the solder joints on the GPU, causing it to separate from the motherboard and causing the video to go completely blank. That's actually how my iBook G4 died. I tried to reflow the solder myself. Not really advised. I ended up actually frying my motherboard on that model, but hey, it was broken already, so I thought I'd give it a shot. Also, my 2010 MacBook Pro also had a discrete GPU issue, and as a matter of fact, that's why I now have an early 2011 model, which is really ironic because it might actually suffer from a similar issue. I had my 2010 model replaced under AppleCare with an early 2011 model because of GPU style issues. So one potential workaround if you're being affected by this would be to run an application like GFX Card Status. This is a little menu bar application that lets you know when your Mac is running in integrated GPU mode versus discrete GPU mode and lets you switch between one or the other. So you can force your Mac to go into integrated GPU mode all the time, which would avoid the discrete processor and potentially avoid seeing the issue or the effects of this problem, but that's not really fixing the issue. So if you are suffering from video issues with your early 2011 MacBook Pro, you probably want to report it to Apple, make a Genius Bar appointment, go in, have them take a look at it, and at least get it on the books as having the issue. Because with the size of the support thread surrounding this issue, I would think that Apple will eventually issue a warranty repair program, something to actually address this problem. Also, some users of the MacBook Air, the June 2013 version, report that they are having Wi-Fi issues. This one comes from a 132-page support thread on Apple's support forums. Users report things like dropped packets, inconsistent network connections, high latency, and low data transfer rates from newly refreshed 802.11ac connections. An Apple spokesman told MacNN that a fix for any reported Wi-Fi connectivity issue not related to hardware failure is forthcoming, so that gives a little bit of hope to people who are being hit by this issue. Seems like it might be a software issue, but they did not say when that software update would actually come out. The fix could likely be in macOS 10 Mavericks 10.9.2, which is currently in beta testing and should be out sometime soon. So if you are suffering Wi-Fi issues with your 2013 MacBook Air, you might just have to wait a little while till Apple can actually issue a software patch. I did not see anything or get anything in reports for a workaround, a temporary workaround for that issue. If you happen to know something and want to share it with us, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Apple has released a bevy of software updates over the past week or so. Let's kick things off and talk about the one for iOS developers. iOS 7.1 Beta 4 was released to developers. It's got a couple of interesting things of note in it. One is that the slide to unlock animation, the little animation that goes over the text on the lock screen, is now a bit more prominent. It's brighter. The animation's a little bit slower, so that should make it easier to see, especially against some certain kinds of backgrounds that people might choose to use. The add to contacts link in the phone dialer has been changed. It's no longer the text. It's now just a little plus icon up to the left of the phone number on the dialer screen. If you're in the UK, it sounds like you're going to be getting a new Siri voice on your iPad. I think what's going on is you're going to have the option of a female or male voice, something I don't think you have now. I think you just have a male voice. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure I'll get some emails on that. And the update supposedly also fixes a bug in Messages that was causing it to report messages as not being delivered, even though they were. Now, not something that was part of the iOS 7.1 Beta 4 release, but something that Apple did comment on this week, that is, I think, the most exciting announcement surrounding an update to iOS 7, is the fact that Apple acknowledged the white Apple logo of Death Screen, the one we've all been seeing since running iOS 7, where suddenly your app will quit, something will happen, and boom, you just get an Apple logo. Your iOS device simply reboots itself, right? We've all seen that. I'm seeing plenty of them, I can tell you that. Apple says, yep, that's an issue, and we do promise that it will be fixed. Now, they didn't give a lot of specifics. They didn't say if it would be with iOS 7.1, but I would assume that that is one of the major goals surrounding the next update, is to get rid of that, because I'm sure they're getting plenty of us who are letting them know that it is a problem. As far as when iOS 7.1 will be released to the rest of us, we don't really know, but it's sounding like it could be slated for sometime in March. So it's a little ways off. We're going to have to live with that that white Apple logo just a little bit longer. Apple released an update to iTunes, iTunes 11.4. There was not a lot of details given in the release notes, and actually one of the items in the release notes seemed to not be there. Specifically, the main new feature that was mentioned was that wish lists made their way into the iTunes library, where in the past, the only way to get at an iTunes wish list was from within the App Store. Thing was, when the update came out, nobody could find it. Well, it now appears, at least for me, under the little hamburger menu, the little three lines up in the upper right-hand corner of the iTunes window when you're in your main library. So as long as you've added something to your wish list when you're in the store, you should be able to click on that in the main library and see that. It still exists over in the store side as well. So I think it adds a little bit more consistency into the interface. But it seems like Apple was able to push that update out after they actually released iTunes 11.4, which to me is even more interesting about this update. I didn't know Apple had the ability to actually push out new features after the software had been sort of downloaded. iTunes 11.4 also has improved support for Arabic and Hebrew characters, as well as stability fixes and improvements, along with some additional security updates. So if you haven't picked that up, you can get iTunes 11.4 by running software update on your Mac or just going into the Mac store and running the update. Apple also pushed out a pretty major update to its iWork suite for the Mac, Pages version 5.1, Keynote 6.1, and Numbers 3.1 were all released. I won't bore you with all the details of all the new features and enhancements, but let's just say a lot of the things people complained about when those applications were released are being addressed. So Apple is sort of living up to its promise of continuing to improve those applications. There was also some significant updates to iWork in the cloud, specifically adding the ability to share password-protected documents. So you can now, within each application, create an iCloud link and password protect those documents. And Apple gave iWork for iCloud a little facelift, giving it a lot more iOS 7 style look, so a little bit flatter. And also they added improved voiceover support, which was really nice to see. And lastly, in the iWork suite, Apple also silently removed the old Keynote remote application from the App Store. And that is because Apple has included a lot of the functionality of the old remote app actually within Keynote itself via their integrated remote feature. Now, if you have a copy of the old Keynote remote, it will continue to work with the new versions of the software, but Apple is encouraging you to dump that and go with the new integrated remote feature that's found inside Keynote. Along with the iWork update, iMovie also got a little bit of update love. iMovie 10.0.2 was released. It fixes an issue that could have caused iMovie to quit unexpectedly, resolves issues that could cause sharing to fail, addressed a situation where the share button would not respond, also resolved a situation where project thumbnails could appear blank, fixed an issue where high-resolution photos appeared green on some computers, and resolved cases where crop, Ken Burns, and map features were not accessible on computers using certain languages. All of that along with some general stability improvements and other fixes. And finally, last but not least, the podcast app for iOS. Yes, hallelujah! It got updated and they fixed the enhanced AAC chapters in podcasts. Something froze over. We won't say what it is. It's a family-friendly show. But thank goodness it is fixed. I'm still not going back to it. I'm a downcast user through and through, but I'm very happy to see that that issue was addressed. And they also reportedly addressed an issue with changing album artwork. So very happy to see Apple giving some love to the podcast app this week. They also added a new pull to refresh feature under the My Podcast tab, as well as fixed bugs, including one that caused podcasts to suddenly stop and another one that prevented some subscriptions from updating automatically. So if you do use the podcast app, I recommend you go out and grab that update. Just run a software update on your iOS devices or in iTunes. So the last remaining Mac to get a significant update is the Mac Mini, and it's sounding like, if you believe a Belgian retailer site, that it will be updated soon. Someone in the Mac Rumors forums spotted a placeholder listing on a Belgian Apple retailer website. It shows an updated Mac Mini with a Haswell-based Intel Core i5 and i7 processor Intel Iris graphics, 802.11ac Wi-Fi and gigabit Ethernet, along with the Thunderbolt and the USB and the HDMI and all that other stuff, and reportedly shipping sometime in late February. So if you've been looking to update a Mac Mini, you might want to hold off just a few more weeks, about a month or so, and see if Apple doesn't do an update. It certainly is well due for an update to happen, so I would expect Apple to push that model forward. A little processor update, right? We need to have a little update to our Mac Mini. I love the Mac Mini, one of my favorite models of Mac. I think it's a great part of the lineup, and hopefully Apple continues to produce it for a long, long time. But they seem to hold off on that one always to be the last one that they update anytime they do Mac updates. So it's due, and hopefully we'll see it soon. So I am a pretty big fan of the Apple TV. I love my Apple TV. I think it's a great product. I use it all the time. Well, this week we heard iLounge say that it has reliable sources within the industry that say the Apple TV is going to get a gaming update sometime soon, an update to support games likely coming as soon as March. Apple added to iOS 7 the ability to support Bluetooth controllers. We've seen some of these come out in the form of kind of these controller cases that go around your iPhone and let you play games. I've always felt that that made more sense as an accessory for, say, like an Apple TV. The idea here is that you'd be able to purchase and download games directly on your Apple TV, and it would bring built-in gaming to that product. Now, combining built-in gaming with controllers and then throw in something like iOS integration, using your iOS device as a second screen, and I think game developers could come up with some really interesting new games and concepts and stuff like that surrounding the Apple TV platform. And it certainly would take Apple's gaming efforts in iOS to the next level. Apple has already been sort of crushing it in the mobile game market, especially against some of the portable handheld devices. Now they could really go in, take on, and disrupt something that they really like to do. Disrupt the console game market. I think if I was Nintendo, I would be shaking in my boots because they're kind of thought of with the Wii as the company that is more for the casual gamer. I don't think Apple's going to make any real impact against the hardcore Xbox, Xbox One, PlayStation 4 kind of folks. But for someone like me, I own a Wii. I love my Wii. But if some of that gaming experience could be brought to my Apple TV, that's one less extra box I have to have around, a couple Bluetooth gaming controllers, and away you go. I think it's a great platform, and it extends Apple's App Store into the television. So I think that's a really cool concept, and I think it's something Apple has been playing around with. We've also had some reports that Apple's been experimenting with motion controls, things like a Kinect, you know, that sort of experience, along with their Apple TV products, at least according to some sources. So that could ramp up a whole nother level of gaming. And I think eventually Apple will open up the Apple TV platform to other kinds of apps, but gaming seems a natural place to start. They've already been opening up the platform to content producers. We've seen some of those new channels coming into play, and I think gaming is a next natural step. And then beyond that, other apps. And I think Apple's going to roll them out in a very specific, controlled manner. So the next kind of thing that would make sense, in my opinion, would be news, weather kind of apps, RSS readers, and those sorts of things, and then on to other kinds of applications. But exciting news in the, or rumors at least, surrounding the next generation of Apple TV products. And then finally in the news for this week, rumors that Apple is getting ready to launch their own mobile payment system. Guess who's not surprised? Me. This is something that I thought Apple has been working on. I've thought about it ever since they released their Easy Pay system in Apple retail stores. But this week, the Wall Street Journal says that Tim Cook and Eddie Q have been making the rounds with different technology industry leaders to discuss a possible mobile payment system rollout. And that Apple executive Jennifer Bailey, who ran the company's online store, has been tasked with building out an in-company payment business, at least according to the Wall Street Journal. Now, Tim Cook was specifically asked about this during the quarterly results call. He said that Apple has been quote unquote intrigued with the idea of a mobile payment system, and also said that mobile payments was one of the thoughts behind the Touch ID technology that's in the current generation iPhone 5S. Again, I think this is a natural progression of Apple's in-store Easy Pay system. If you've ever been to an Apple retail store and had a chance to use Easy Pay, it's an awesome, awesome thing. You go into the retail store, you pick up a product off the shelf, you open up Apple's App Store app, you scan in the product, and you pay with your iTunes account. Apple already has your credit card data on file. It makes it super simple to pay. Combine that with something like Touch ID for security. Add in something like iBeacon technology so that when you're in the store, you can get promotions and offers and coupons and discounts and things like that. And the fact that retailers could roll this into their own apps. So when I go into a store, I open up that retailer's app. They can make me offers. I can use that for my payment. And it's all tied into my Apple ID and my iTunes account. So the retailer doesn't have to have any of my credit card data. I don't even have to take my credit card out of my wallet, right? I know there's one source for my payments, and it's Apple. That, to me, is a single point of sort of security, and I really like the idea behind that. So it's something I think it's very desirable in light of all of the credit card and data information hijacking that's happened at retailers like Target and Michaels. Get that stuff out of the credit card swipers and things like that. Move it into a device that I'm already carrying around, my iPhone. And that's a really, really powerful and easy system. And we know how many millions and millions of iTunes accounts and credit cards Apple already has on file. Steve Jobs was very fond of letting us know just how many and how powerful that whole payment platform is. So if Apple can extend that beyond their retail stores into other stores and outlets, I think that's going to be a really, really cool thing. So I hope this is one rumor that ends up being true. Now, there was no information given on when this might actually hit retail stores or which retailers Apple's specifically been talking to. But again, I think it'll be kind of a controlled rollout. Some of their partners they've worked with in the past, Starbucks, places like that, seem like logical options. But we'll have to wait and see what Apple ends up doing on this front. But I think this is something that is going to crush and blow away NFC, in my opinion, and I look forward to the day when it happens. So the Mac turned 30 years old this past week. It was on January 26th, just a couple days ago, as I record this, and I started to feel kind of nostalgic. I also realized that I have been a Mac user for 28 of those 30 years. So that means, one, I'm really, really old. Two, I've been a Mac user for a really long time. And I've actually been an Apple user for even longer than that. My first computer was actually an Apple IIgs. And I actually shared the story of sort of my Apple and Mac history on a recent episode of the MacCast member program. So if you're a member and haven't caught that yet, go ahead and take a listen. If you'd like to become a member, you can check that out. But I'll give you the short version of the story. The short version is that the main reason I'm an Apple user and why I love Apple technology is that the technology is always secondary to the task or whatever I'm trying to get done. It's not just a tool. The Mac is not just a tool, but it actually becomes an assistant, something that helps me get done the kinds of creative projects and the things that I want to get done. And I don't, you know I'm an unapologetic Apple fan, right? I think that's pretty obvious. But I also have spent time as a Windows user. I programmed Windows for 6 years. I did Microsoft C#.net programming. So I went into work every day. I worked with a PC. I came home and I played on my Mac. And not just played, I worked on my Mac too, because I started the podcast when I was a Windows programmer. And so the thing about the PC was that the technology would often hinder the process of what I was trying to do. Not always. And this is when the technology is functioning properly. Let's take that out of the equation right away. I mean, when your Mac isn't working, it's getting in your way of your creative process or whatever, what have you. But what I'm talking about is your PC's functioning properly, your Mac's functioning properly. Too often on the PC, it would inhibit my ability to get work done. It was just cumbersome. It was hard to get in and find things. Things were buried. It wasn't intuitive. It wasn't an assistive technology. The Mac and Apple products to me have always been something that enable and help me get work done. So that's the main reason I think that I'm a Mac owner versus a PC owner. There's all kinds of people that like to mess around and tweak and tinker with technology. That's not the experience I'm really looking for when I'm sitting down to write something, or when I'm sitting down to record a podcast, or when I'm sitting down to create a movie. I don't want to wrestle and mess around with the technology. I don't need a million bells and whistles. I just need it to be efficient at the task and to get me to the conclusion. And I think the Mac is just better positioned at doing that, because I think Apple really focuses on the experience first, not the technology. So the technology follows the experience. And I think that's something that's uniquely Apple. It's something that's ingrained in their DNA. But after I recorded that episode, I asked for some feedback on, why are we Mac users? Why are you a Mac user? And Dan sent me this.
Hey, this is Dan Riker, and I wanted to share why I have become an Apple fan. And I came to the Mac for reasons that are probably very similar to many other people. And yet, the reason I've become a fan is maybe different than many. When I was a senior in high school, I lost the majority of my vision. I was mostly blind for about a year and a half. And amazingly, I got some of my vision back in the very middle of my field of vision after about a year and a half. But during that year and a half period, I used some pretty amazing technology at the time. It was 1991, and I had this little laptop computer that had a screen reader in it, and it would read everything that I typed. Some great organizations around my area had fundraised to help me get this, and I was still able to go to college, and it was awesome. But when I got my sight back, you know, my life really improved. I was able to see and now able to read again, as long as I got the text real big. And I found that I could function with a computer, a normal computer, just get a decent sized screen and get the text pretty big and get real close to the screen. And I was able to get by. And then I eventually moved to the Mac for reasons that many of you would probably relate to. And yet, once I got on the Mac, I realized that Apple had built into their computers screen reading software, or a screen reader that would cost around $1,000 on a PC. And I had never justified that expense because, well, I'm getting by, you know. But now I had this awesome screen reader that I was able to use again, and it really helped me. And then the iPhone came out, and I thought, no way am I ever going to get one of those. A touch screen for a visually impaired guy? That's ridiculous. I love my palm with the buttons I can touch tactily, and I can be able to type, even though it's really hard for me to see on this tiny screen. I can still, you know, I can still get by, and I loved having that pocket computer. And then Apple put accessibility into the iPhone as well, and I went ahead and tried it. And again, they've just significantly improved my standard of living, being able to have this little device that I can talk to and have talk back to me and give me auditory feedback is amazing. And again, you'd be paying $600 to $1,000, I think, to try to get this kind of functionality on a very limited phone of some other type. So I really appreciate Apple, and I'm an Apple fan, very committed to them at this point because of that commitment to accessibility. And I just really think it's honorable that they have done that.
Yeah, that's something amazing that Apple does and has done for years and years and years. And the other half of that, I think, that's really important is that Apple makes that technology easily available to their developers, so that developers can integrate the voiceover and other assistive technologies into their applications and do it in a way that doesn't take a lot of extra effort. It does take some extra effort. Not every developer takes advantage of it, but the fact that it's there is a really amazing thing. So just another great reason to be an Apple fan. It's sort of like the exceeding expectations, right? They usually just blow you away. You're expecting one thing that's really, really good, and they give you the thing that's really great, right? Insanely great, as Steve Jobs used to say. So I think there's lots of different reasons why people gravitate to Apple products and the Mac. And if you'd like to share your story with us, please send it in. I only ask that you try and keep it brief, maybe 3 to 5 minutes, somewhere in that range. And maybe over the next couple episodes and shows and things like that, we can share some of your stories. I love hearing these kinds of stories, and I'm always curious why people landed on the Mac or ended up as an Apple user or a Mac user. I guess we got to extend it to Apple user now, because a lot of us just have iOS devices, iPhones and iPads, those sorts of things. So I look forward to hearing your stories. I mentioned it earlier, but I want to let you know again, Apple, you know, the Mac turned 30 this past week, 30 years old, and Apple updated their website with this cool little kind of, I don't know if you'd call it a mini site, but a couple of pages that are really, really neat and that go over the history of the Mac. They have a bunch of well-known famous people and icons in the fields of entertainment and science and technology that talk about, or little stories about, how they use their Macs and technology and stuff like that, and which Macs they first owned, those sorts of things. So sort of like the story Dan just shared with us. But they have all that stuff on their website, and as part of that, they have this little survey, what was your first Mac? And when you go on there, they have these little hand-drawn line illustrations of all the different models of Macs. Well, turns out a friend of the folks at 9to5 Mac noticed that the little Mac icons that are on those pages are actually a font. They're a TrueType font, and you can actually download and install this font on your Mac. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but basically you download the file from the link, and then it's a TrueType font, so it's a .ttf file. You just double-click on it, should open up inside Fontbook, and you'll be able to install the Mac icon standard font, and then it'll have all the different line illustrations of all the Macs ever made, and you can type them out and do different sizes, and they're all vector illustrations, so you can scale them up as big as you'd like, and they look really, really great. So I thought that was pretty cool, and I just wanted to point that out in case you noticed those on Apple's website and wanted to get some copies of them for yourself. Last episode, we had Ara Derderian from the HDTV podcast on, and he gave us a little update on his Mac home theater system. And as part of that, we talked about the fact that he has a Blu-ray player. I think he picked it up from OWC, MacSales.com. And in that episode, he mentioned that he uses the Blu-ray for ripping his Blu-ray discs or backing up his Blu-ray discs, but he doesn't use it for playback, mainly because there's no playback software built into Mac OS X for playing Blu-ray discs. Well, John says that he actually has a recommendation and a way that you can do just that.
Adam, this is John from beautiful Palos Verdes, California. A quick comment on your show about Media Center setup. Your guest said he didn't know how to watch a Blu-ray on a Mac, even with a Blu-ray player. It's easy with a program called iSoft Mac Blu-ray Ripper. That's spelled AISEESOFT. It costs about $40, but it just plays Blu-rays without any fuss. Also, the process you described, you both described, for ripping Blu-rays is simpler than the two-step process that you discussed with a program called PavTube ByteCopy. It's a successor to PavTube Blu-ray Ripper and is a one-click program that turns Blu-rays and DVDs into your favorite movie file format. There are scores of file format options. Again, it's not free, but it's simple. I love your show, and please keep up the great work.
Hey, thanks, John. I appreciate the recommendation. And I've always pronounced the name of that company AIC. AISEE, AICSoft.com, if people want to check that software out. My only issue with those applications is, for whatever reason, to me, they look like hastily ported Windows or X11 apps. I will fully admit at this point that I am a complete GUI snob. And, you know, why wouldn't I be? Apple has completely spoiled us, right? So when I see an application and it's not quite as polished as I think it could be, I get a little turned off. But, you know, functionality is the main thing here. And I really, you know, if it does the job, then that's good, right? Getting the job done is important. But, you know, just seriously, would it kill you to spend a few bucks and hire a good designer and work on your UI a little bit? But because of that, I decided to do a little bit of Googling and see if there wasn't some other alternatives for doing Blu-ray playback on your Mac. And my search turned up a Macworld article that pointed out an application called Aurora Blu-ray Player for Mac. Now, it's $30, again, just like your application's not free, but it looked like it had a much more Mac-like UI to it for those people who are sensitive to that sort of thing. But I think $30 for just a player is a little more expensive than what you were recommending, which I think has some more functionality beyond just being a Blu-ray player. So just a couple options for people, and I thought I'd point that out. I'll have a link to the Macworld article and to the software, both your recommendations and mine, in the show notes at maccast.com. Now, John actually also had a question for us about his MacBook Pro, which he recently upgraded to a 1 terabyte hard drive. He has 300 gigabytes free, or had 300 gigabytes free, and suddenly noticed that he lost about 100 gigabytes and remembered something I had said on a previous show about Time Machine backing up to your internal hard drive when it couldn't find the external drive. And John, you asked me if that was true. And yep, it actually is true. It's a feature that's built into Mac OS X and has been for a while, something called Time Machine Local Snapshots. And I actually covered it back in August of 2012, so I would say you have a pretty good memory. But what happens is that if you're using Time Machine with probably a laptop, that's most commonly how you're going to see it, and you disconnect the Time Machine drive, so you're out and about, Time Machine will continue to make backups, but it uses your internal hard drive to do that. If you want to see these backups, they're actually stored off the root of your hard drive in the Volumes folder inside a folder called Mobile Backups. So you can use the Go menu in the Finder to actually go to that folder. So /volumes/mobile backups, and you'll see them there. The thing is that it will only do those backups if there's 20% free disk space or more available. And when your Mac's disk space gets to about 80% full, it's going to go ahead and overwrite any older local snapshots to create new ones. So it'll never fill up your drive beyond 20%. And OS X and other applications don't count or see that space used by local snapshots as being used. So they still have it available for storage. So even though you seem to have lost that 100 gigabytes probably to the local snapshots, it would still be available for your applications to use if they needed that space. So if you needed to put some big files on your drive, it's just going to simply wipe away those local snapshots. So the operating system is kind of designed to handle that. And as a matter of fact, the Finder and Disk Utility typically won't even show you the storage used up by the local snapshots, but you can see it using the Get Info window or the About This Mac window. So if you go up under the Apple menu and you choose About This Mac and then click on the little More Info button in that window that appears, you can click on the Storage tab of the More Info window. And under the used space, you'll be able to see the space used up by the local snapshots by looking at the section labeled backups. So if you want to see if you have those, you can, again, check the mobile backups folder inside the volumes folder and also check the more info window under About This Mac and see all that information. In addition, if you don't like the idea of Time Machine creating those local snapshots, you can actually disable the feature. You're going to have to use the terminal to do it, though. So if you're a little bit antsy or worrisome about that sort of thing, you might want to just avoid this tip. But you can launch the terminal. Just go into Applications Utilities Terminal and issue the command sudo tmutil, so like time machine utility, tmutil, and then issue the command disable local, all one word, and hit enter. You'll need to enter your admin credentials, and I'll have the exact command in the show notes at maccast.com, because as always, when you're working in the terminal, you want to type the commands exactly. But you'll put that command in, you'll need to enter your admin credentials, and that will actually turn it off. To re-enable it, you just issue the same command, but instead of disable local, you say enable local. So sudo tmutil enable local is the command, and that'll turn it back on. And you can also use the tmutil, the time machine utility, to force a snapshot to happen, a local snapshot. So if you want to see all this functioning, you can actually play around with it and test it using the terminal. Now, if you disable the local snapshot feature, you can actually verify that it's turned off by going into the time machine system preferences pane. So go into system preferences, time machine, after issuing that command, and if it's off, you'll no longer see the time machine keeps local backups as space permits text in the time machine preferences window. If you've disabled the feature. If you haven't disabled the feature, there'll be this little message in that window that says time machine keeps local backups as space permits. So there you go. That is local snapshots in time machine. So buying a Mac, that can be something that can be a little bit stressful. You know, buying a new Mac, whether it's a new Mac, your first Mac, you're replacing an old Mac, whatever it may be, you know, Apple is constantly changing the lineup. They're changing different configurations. They're putting in different options, things like that, and sort of trying to figure out, you know, which is the right model for me? How do I pick this feature versus that feature? What's going to be better for my given situation? That can be, you know, a little bit stressful and a little bit cumbersome. And sometimes you just need a little bit of help. So Casey actually had this question for us.
Hi, Adam. Casey Broughton from Kelowna, BC here, and I wanted some advice about a few questions I had regarding upgrading my Mac. My current Mac is a mid-2010 white MacBook 7.1 that is 3.5 years old with a 250GB hard drive and 4GB of RAM. It recently had the piece of plastic around the Ethernet port and power socket crack and fall off, leaving me with a laptop Mac that I can't move around much due to fear of it falling apart. I'm planning on buying the top-of-the-line 13-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display in a couple months, but we'll probably have to choose two upgrades out of the following: a bigger SSD, 512GB to 1TB, more memory, 8 to 16GB, or a better processor, 2.6 to 2.8GHz. My first question is whether or not to purchase in April-May, as I don't know how much about the MacBook Retina release cycle. My second question is, which of these upgrades might suit my situation best? I am a student on a fixed income, hence the waiting to purchase, and will probably need this Mac to run well for the next 4 to 6 years. My third question is, which method might be best to transfer my data to the new laptop once I have it? I have my data backed up via Time Machine to an external USB 3 drive, but I am also considering using Migration Assistant directly via an Ethernet adapter. Does either way have any particular pros or cons? Thanks for the help.
Hey, Casey, let's see if we can help you out with this. Starting with the first question, right? Buying date. When is the right time to buy? Good time to buy? You know, is the April, May timeframe going to be good for you? And the answer, unfortunately, is it's hard to say. You never really know with Apple. We can look at historical trends, like, take, for example, last year, Apple updated the line in February of 2013, and then they did it again in October last year. This is the MacBook Pro line. They've also in the past, though, had summer updates, the June update, somewhere around WWDC. So we've seen that release cycle also. If I were a betting man, my best guess is that this year they might do a summer update. I think it's more likely personally because they went with a whole new architecture in October, the Haswell architecture, and Intel really hasn't made any major changes since then. They just did a small rev of the processors, but nothing really, really big, and I don't think it would require a big update to the MacBook Pro line, say, in February. But That said, that could mean that your timing is actually perfect, because if Apple does end up doing a rev in February, March, then it's right in line for your timing to buy your new MacBook Pro. If not, I would say wait a month or two, wait until June around WWDC and see what happens, see if Apple doesn't put out a new model. But I always think, you know, timing-wise, if you can work it out, the minute Apple releases a new update, that's the perfect time to buy. Now, some people are going to argue with me against that, because a lot of people feel you shouldn't buy the model right when it comes out, because it could have production issues, it might have unresolved bugs and hardware sorts of things. And that certainly does happen. But in my mind, you've got AppleCare at that point, so you can usually get those sorts of things fixed. But, you know, that's just my two cents on that whole part of it. Now, talking about which upgrades to get, well, if you can get two, you're in a pretty good situation, because what I would say is I always prioritize my spending on upgrades like this. RAM first, then hard disk, SSD, then screen size, model, if you're playing around with those options, and then lastly, processor. I think processor is the least bang for your buck, especially with the modern processors. Now, that's assuming you're sticking with like 4-core versus 4-core, something like that. If you're adding multiple cores, that may change a little bit, but even still, I would lean likely more toward adding more RAM or increasing my hard disk space before I would mess around with processor options. Now, RAM is the number one for me, because especially with the current lineup of MacBook Pros, because you can't upgrade it later. So if you're looking for longevity, I think you mentioned trying to get 4 to 6 years of use out of that, you're going to want at least 8 gigabytes of RAM, and I'm thinking more 16, or as much as you possibly could afford. That's what I would put in there, because again, you're not going to be able to go in and add more later. The flash storage, that can't be upgraded either, but you always have the option, if you're running out of storage, with going with an external solution. So you can use a Thunderbolt drive or a USB 3 drive and do that route. Of course, you're still going to sacrifice portability at that point, but if you have a squeezed budget, at least it's an option, right? Personally, if you can afford the RAM and the 1 terabyte flash, get both, and it sounds like you can. So that's totally what I would do. I'd get the model with maxed out RAM, as much RAM as I possibly could, and the 1 terabyte flash drive. Again, that's assuming the I want this thing to last 4 to 6 years of usage. If you're going to be replacing it sooner, say 2 to 3 years, you might be able to get away with a little less hard drive and spend your money elsewhere. It's really kind of up to you and your use cases and how you think you're going to be able to eke the most lifetime or the most longevity out of your new Mac. The last question, I guess, is about moving data. And, you know, that really doesn't matter too much. If you're using Migration Assistant, whether you're doing a direct connection or going over gigabit Ethernet, so I mean direct connection from a backup drive, say a Time Machine drive or a clone drive, or whether you're going gigabit from one Mac to another, not going to matter too much. The gigabit Ethernet might be a little bit faster, but that's about it. The whole process itself, sort of how it all works, is going to work fine over either solution. So I wouldn't worry about that one too much. And I think that answers all the questions. Oh, one thing I meant to mention earlier about the, you know, when do I buy sort of thing. Another hard and fast rule I've always used is that you buy a new Mac when you need it. So I'm not a firm believer in holding off a purchase when you actually need a new machine to get work done. So this is the kind of use case where I had a Mac and I dropped it into the pool and now it's destroyed and I have no machine. Well, guess what? You need to go out and if you rely on that thing for work, you've got to go out and buy a new machine. If it's just time for you to buy a new system, even if it's the case where your old machine has just gotten so slow that you've become really non-productive, that productivity you're going to gain by buying a new Mac, even if a new model comes out a week after you just made your purchase, and in that scenario, you could actually fall under Apple's return policy, take it back and get the new one. But let's say you bought it and it was a month, right? A month later, the new model comes out. You don't want to be kicking yourself because guess what? You got a month of really good productive usage out of that machine, and that's probably more valuable than what you're missing out on by getting the newest, latest, and greatest model, right? That's just my opinion on that. Some people will probably disagree with me, but you know, if you need a Mac, buy it when you need it and just max it out. Get the best possible Mac you can afford. And like I said, I kind of use that RAM, hard drive, screen size model, processor as the hierarchy of my decision tree. So I hope you find that information useful. And when you get your new Mac, hey, just enjoy it. And then finally for today, we heard from Dan earlier about why he's an Apple fan and a Mac user. Well, Dan also recently ran into a little problem with his Fusion Drive Mac, and it's something that you may have run into as well, or if you're considering a Fusion Drive Mac, you probably should know about. So here's what Dan had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Dan Riker, and I wanted to share with you my experience with my new 27-inch iMac equipped with the Fusion Drive. I ran into some unexpected issues with this computer. I'm a musician, and I often work with worship teams, and I teach music, and so I'm recording quick little demos in both of those situations, and I'll often just use the mic on my Macs to do that rather than getting out an audio interface and higher quality mics. The mic on the Macs do work just fine for that, except for this new one. This fancy new computer has some noise cancellation technology in it that interprets my guitar or my piano if I'm playing and singing. It interprets those instruments as background noise and starts filtering them out in this weird way. And so I'm sure that's great for FaceTime calls and improving dictation accuracy, but in my case, it's a real problem, and Apple couldn't give me a good solution for that. There's no checkbox in the audio preferences like there normally is to turn off noise filtering. Maybe that's something they'll fix in Mavericks in an update. But so far, there hasn't been a fix. I even took my guitar into the Apple Store and serenaded them a little bit, and sure enough, it was the same issue on other iMacs. And so I broke down and got a USB mic, the Blue Yeti. It arrived. I was excited to go ahead and use that. And about a minute or 3 minutes in, it would start popping and clicking and just sound horrible, totally unusable. Finally, I found a support thread on an Apple website with a number of other people having this issue. And it was all pointing towards computers that have the Fusion Drive on them. And they're the ones that are experiencing this issue. I talked with pretty high-level tech support at Apple, and they admitted that there's a problem, but they couldn't give me a good solution or a time frame of when it might be fixed. So I was at the end of my 30-day period, having got my computer at the beginning of December, and my tech guy suggested that I should, or the support Apple support person suggested maybe I should just go ahead and return it at that point. So I did. I'm now recording this on my new 27-inch iMac without the Fusion Drive. I upgraded the RAM to 16 gigabytes instead of 8, and the mic works perfectly on it. So I'm now recording this on the Blue Yeti, and it's working fine, but I came across a couple of odd issues getting to this point, and I thought I would share them with you.
Hey, thanks, Dan. Appreciate you sharing that with us. That was something I was totally unaware of. I hadn't heard of that issue, and being an audio guy, obviously being a podcaster, that would be something that would concern me. And you're absolutely right. There's a long support thread describing the issue on Apple's support website, and there's actually one really good user tip article that I found in the Logic Pro section that actually covers this and some other USB audio interface issues and some kind of workarounds and things that you can do. Like you said, the audio problem sort of manifests itself as this sort of popping, crackling noise. So if you've been experiencing that and you have a Fusion Drive Mac, you might try a couple of these workarounds, or here's just some ideas or possible solutions for you. One would be to boot your Mac when you need to record from an external hard drive. and make sure that the Fusion Drive is not accessed at all during your recording session, meaning that you're going to want to turn things off, like any backups, Time Machine that might be running, stuff that might cause the drive to act, the Fusion Drive to actually activate and spin up. Make sure you're not using it as your scratch disk or writing any data or reading any data from the Fusion Drive. Probably a little bit tricky to do, but might work to kind of get you through until Apple brings out a fix. Another idea would be to split the Fusion Drive, and I wasn't even aware you could do this until I started researching this article. You can actually go in and separate the SSD portion from the mechanical drive portion in the Fusion Drive, and Macworld has a pretty nice article about how to do this. I'll try to make sure to have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, but I will say it's not for the faint of heart. It's definitely not supported by Apple. It's going to require you go into the terminal and use some utilities and issue some commands. Absolutely make sure you have a backup before you even get close to attempting this, because if you mess it up, I would assume you could mess up your drive and your data. And even once you've been able to successfully separate your Fusion Drive, you're going to be left with a couple of weird quirks. One being that you're not able to format the drives with disk utility. You're going to have to do it from this little command line tool. Another thing is that splitting the Fusion Drive eliminates the recovery partition in OS X, meaning that if you need to recover, you're going to have to boot from either a USB key, so make sure you have a copy of the operating system on a bootable USB key or some external drive, or be sure that you're going to be able to have access to the internet so you can do the internet recovery version of the OS X recovery. So there's that. Separate the drive. The third option would be to do exactly like you did, Dan. Contact Apple and ask for a replacement iMac, something without a Fusion Drive. And then the last thing would be just simply wait it out, wait for Apple to issue a fix. Like you said, it sounds like they're aware of the issue, so hopefully a fix is forthcoming. Although the Fusion Drive Macs have been out for a while and we haven't seen a fix yet, so I'm not entirely certain how big of a priority, or it makes it seem like this is not a huge priority for Apple. It is kind of this isolated scenario, but you know, a lot of us use our Macs for recording audio, and USB audio interfaces are pretty popular. So I have to have a feeling that this affects a pretty large number of users, even though it's kind of a specific issue. The only other thing I want to comment on is the whole noise canceling mic thing. Now, I'm going to say right up front, I have no idea how noise canceling technology works. You know, so this was the scenario where you were trying to use the built-in mics, but it was filtering out your guitar, your instrument. I'm wondering, would covering up the second mic, the one that picks up the audio to do the noise canceling, would actually blocking that mic serve to kind of disable the noise canceling feature, almost like doing it mechanically? So I'm thinking, like, put a piece of tape over the mic hole, which is actually hiding above the Apple logo on the back of your iMac. Would that actually do anything to stop the noise canceling, or would that just make it worse? I have no idea. If anybody knows anything about noise canceling technology and can let us know, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their software and get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed and listening. Please, I love hearing from you. Keep your emails and your audio comments coming. If you have a question, a comment, a topic you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Send your audio comments there just as attachments. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, social media, Twitter, Facebook, Google, I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/maccast. You can find the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast. And you'll find us on Google Plus. Just search for Google or MacCast rather on Google Plus, and you should find the MacCast community there. And I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.